We are pulling together the community and the businesses, especially the traders, and asking them to decorate their shopfronts in green in memory of Dermot O'Toole.
Welcome to this week's edition of Eye on the Peninsula, Tuesday the 12th of July, with details of a candlelight vigil to be held this evening in Hastings. We'll hear more on the tribute for murdered Dermot O'Toole later in the program. Good afternoon, Piers Cunningham broadcasting from the RPPFM studios in Mornington. Today we had another packed current affairs news report with Port Phillip Bay keeper Mr. Neil Blake saying it's time to start monitoring water levels in the bay. We hear from Environment Minister and Member for Flinders Greg Hunt and his victory in the last election. The Bandicoot is back with an update on local councillors' spending. We continue last week's report on the complexities around summer's concrete footpaths. It's 3 years today since Hastings jeweller Dermot O'Toole was killed at the hands of a man affected by ice. We hear about the candlelight vigil. Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock comments on the fate of the submarine Otama. And Sam Mills interviews a local Olympian hopeful. But now, Environment Minister and Member for Flinders Greg Hunt won his seat again in the election, but his popularity has waned somewhat according to the numbers released by the AEC. In the previous election, Mr. Hunt held an 11.8% margin over the two preferred parties. But in this election, the margin dropped by 3.84% to a 7.9% margin. Deborah Maher spoke exclusively to Minister Hunt to discuss his re-elected policies and projects lined up for his electorate. She starts by congratulating him on his win.
I feel a sense of immense honour and grace to be given the opportunity. I don't take it remotely lightly. You have to earn the honour and the trust and the responsibility from the electorate, and I suspect on where the postal votes are at, we'll probably end at about 58% of the two-party preferred, which is a little better than I was hoping. And then to have Chris Cruther next door, he's going to be a great asset. And together we've been able to get a lot of very good commitments to the peninsula, which we now set about delivering. We grew about 15% as an electorate from 100 to 115,000 over the course of the last term. And that was whilst keeping the same boundary. So
Wow. You
can see that through Somerville and Rosebud, Mount Martha, and then in the Phillip Island area, and Cooey Rup in particular, we had some very, very significant growth. So all of those things come together, and 15% growth across the electorate is dramatically faster than the national average.
Prime Minister Turnbull's performance before and during the election campaign has not met expectation, with his popularity decreasing among his party and the Australian public. This is Mr. Hunt's response to a question about his interest in the PM's job.
That's very nice of you. I both hope and believe that Malcolm Turnbull will be the leader of the Liberal Party and the Prime Minister for the entire next term. My best estimate is that we'll have about 76 seats, which in a 150-seat parliament does represent a slim majority. Now, there's a chance it could be 75 and a chance it could be 77, but 76 was my view the morning after the election, and that hasn't changed. The postal votes and the trends have gone pretty much as we expected. And, you know, I think very, very highly of Malcolm Turnbull. Immensely bright, immensely capable, immensely determined, and very focused on what government means for, you know, Australians who in many cases are struggling with their bills. They wonder about their job security. And that is the sort of thing we do talk about and the sort of thing we talk about in the cabinet. So,
well, what was the problem then, do you think? Because he's only been there for a short time, not a long time, to give us a real feel of what he can achieve. So what has the issue been in the last couple of months he's been in?
Well, firstly, whether it was the first term of the Hawke government, the Howard government, the Rudd government or our government, there is always a considerable drawback. We'll probably lose about 3% compared with where we were at the last election. The Howard government lost 4.9 and then went on to have four very, very solid and capable terms. So I think there is a natural swinging back to the centre. four out of our last nine elections have been decided by under 1%. That's just an Australian thing. And then, of course, we probably need to focus even more fully on cost of living for, you know, people who are on lower incomes, and that is immensely important. And I understand that and I hear that message.
Mr Hunt discusses some of the re-election promises he and the member for Dunkley, Chris Crowther, are working on, starting with the $192 million commit to step up the national mental health reforms across Frankston and the Mornington Peninsula. He begins with the ICE epidemic.
The South East Melbourne in particular, the peninsula, has been designated as a national mental health priority area. And that's not just mental health, but that one of the huge drivers of the challenge is ICE and drug dependency. If I picked up one incredibly important thing from the campaign in terms of my community, that is that the ICE epidemic is even deeper than I'd realised. And just the extent of the ICE issue, and therefore the relationship with mental health, and that both mental health feeds into drug dependency and drug dependency feeds into mental health.
And which leads into homelessness, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, there was also discussions that Sydney in King's Cross are looking at ICE safe houses where they can actually shoot up. Do you think that's a good idea to bring into Victoria and say on the Mornington Peninsula is a need for that?
I respect the view and the approach. I'd need to know a lot more. I'd be pretty cautious myself. I think our goal is to work on the one side on the policing, but on the other on the health side, and to try to bring people off and to work through that combination of education, of dealing very toughly with the dealers, but very humanely with those who've got a use or an addiction problem. So, you know, my goal and our goal is to try to get people off, not to facilitate at this stage. On the health and medical side, what we've managed to achieve was overarching the whole ICE focus and the funding for mental health and ICE on the peninsula. Then secondly, the MRI bulk billing for Frankston Hospital. Thirdly, the hospice support for Mornington Hospice. And then fourthly, the $1 million for supported accommodation for those with disability or mental health issues, Rosebud.
Road safety is high on the Mornington Peninsula Shire's agenda. And with the introduction of the Towards Zero Road Safety campaign, which is part of Victoria's Road Safety Strategy and Action Plan, the Coalition Government is on board to support the cause. Mr Hunt reiterates some re-election promises, starting with...
So some of the road projects include the corner of Forest Drive and the Pan Highway in Mount Martha. Some of it, we have the upgrades near the corner of Bungarra Road and Tyab Turidan Road. And then we have those support in Hastings for getting the monkey bikes out of West Park Wallaroo. And so there's funding for there, and then funding for the Rye closed circuit television, so $200,000 in Rye. Obviously, there was a terrible tragedy a couple of years ago. And then on the extremely positive side, you've got the support for sports package to encourage young people. You know, getting young people involved in sport is just such a fundamental thing. So there's the Mornington Little House, there's a whole package across Frankston, the support for women's sport in Tyab and Dramana, and then the peninsula playing fields.
Well, that can be part of the solution, Greg, because if you get them occupied and accountable to some organisation, that helps.
That's exactly right. So a combination of the active sport and then the diversion away from the ice, and then for those that really do need the assistance, the medical, the MRI, the supported accommodation, and then obviously at the end of life, the hospice assistance. You put all of those things together and that's a pretty good outcome.
The Great Barrier Reef is experiencing unprecedented bleaching and land runoff. What solutions does Mr Hunt have in place to preserve the reef?
It's been one of the great passions of my life. We inherited a reef which was on the World Heritage in Danger watch list from the previous Labor and Greens government, and we took it off. They praised Australia as the global role model. We put $460 million in prior to the election. And then during the election, we pledged an extra $1 billion reef fund, and the Prime Minister and I worked on that together. and just one of the critical things to deliver in this term, and we will. So I'm very, very happy about that. That's about reducing runoff from sediment and nitrogen and pesticides that comes down the river. It's about killing off crown of thorns and then contributing to the great global challenge of reducing global emissions.
Closer to home, Mr. Hunt announced a $2 million federal government backing to facilitate Melbourne University's development of a marine research centre in the quarantine station precinct at Point Nepean. Will this help monitor water levels in the bay, protect marine life, and control the impact to the environment, especially if there needs to be future dredging?
My hope is that we will have one of the world's great coastal and marine and climate facilities here on the peninsula.
And where will that start, Greg?
So that's now with Melbourne University. It's with them to get it in place. They'll work on their timetable. They've got to complete the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's with the state government. But I think it's really, it's a project that I've lived and breathed because I've firstly fought against plans by Defence in my first term to sell off Point Nepean, and we won that. But then fought against plans by, the current state to turn it into hotels and other things, current state government. And now I think it's at its best place. It's funded, Melbourne University is committed, the state has got a provisional memorandum of understanding with Melbourne University. And so that's really the right use of what is a small town that's actually there in the old defence and quarantine buildings at Point Nepean.
So we're looking maybe in the next couple of years that we'll see some progress over that.
I won't put an actual time because Melbourne University is already looking at continuous use and then increasing that progressively until you've got your student population in full-time residence. But the whole point is some of the buildings are Melbourne University, the others are, will be community and arts, and you put them all together and you'll have a really lively precinct in the old quarantine station, literally the best part of 100 buildings there, and you'll have a great national park which is arguably underutilised, but if you've got that human attraction and the natural attraction, then that's just a guarantee that 30 and 50 and 100 years from now it will be in public hands and in public use, not hived off to private developers. Yeah, it's beautiful and it's historic. It's just a great place.
And lastly, with the greying population growing at a high rate on the peninsula, there is a focus on the redevelopment of the Rosebud Hospital.
Other things to work on, and I really want to work on with Peninsula Health, the redevelopment of the Rosebud Hospital. It's not an election commitment because you have to have the state on board first, but just to work constructively with the state to get us to the point of a new Rosebud Hospital, and whether it's 100 or 150 beds, I think really working on that would be just a great thing to do.
Fantastic.
It's always about keeping the balance.
Eye on the Peninsula will follow the Minister's progress and the unveiling of these future projects. Stay tuned, because soon we learn about the fate of the charity City Life. But now, what's happening to water levels in our bay? Victoria's Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning is reporting a natural, cyclical and evolutionary change occurring along the Mornington Peninsula shoreline. Local Port Phillip baykeeper Neil Blake is taking the government to task on the issue, believing it's not entirely natural and cyclical. RPFM presenter Brendan Telfer invited the baykeeper on the Breakfast Club program yesterday to discuss his plans and initiatives. Brendan begins with Neil's reaction to the Victorian Department's report.
There's always going to be natural processes occurring and possibly cyclical, but obviously other interventions will be at play as well. The channel deepening project obviously did have an impact, and that's something that it was always, the impacts were going to be masked to a certain extent by climate change and other natural processes. So, but we have a bigger problem on our hands, and that's the future. And how do we manage that?
Well, indeed. So what you've done is you've basically been monitoring this situation for the last 5 years, is my understanding. You've been taking sort of empirical measures up and down the Mornington Peninsula coastline. Is that right?
Well, I've had a couple of locations. I've been particularly photo documenting Observatory Point and also keeping a close eye on what's happened at ports in more recent times. So I've developed a water level method just so that I can actually take readings of the sand levels across any given beach. And that's more to the sense of just enabling ordinary people to get involved in having an understanding of what's going on. And also creating a maths out of the classroom exercise for schools or geography activities so that young students can get involved as well and get some learning out of it.
So you're just about, I believe, to launch this campaign or this observation method, and you're calling for volunteers up and down the Mornington Peninsula to give you some assistance.
Yeah, we've actually got a project around Port Phillip Bay. We're encouraging people to get involved in a range of citizen science activities, and one of them is the coastal beach profile monitoring. I'm going to be down at Macrae this Thursday to just demonstrate to anyone who's interested how the method works, and hopefully we might be able to recruit a few people that will be interested in taking that up to do regular monitoring in down on the peninsula.
Macrae has its own issues, reports Neil.
That's an interesting beach in the sense that there already has been historic sort of interventions in that poor beach erosion down there in the past. And the other interesting thing, though, is that there is a fairly significant drainage outlet crossing the beach too, at that section there. So they're the sort of, you know, the interchange between the bay and the stormwater system is one of the things that we're interested in keeping an eye on, because that's obviously going to have major implications for the future in terms of managing the stormwater infrastructure.
Neil, when you look into the future, do you despair about what is happening on Port Phillip Bay, or are you optimistic?
The bay is obviously going to be challenged into the future. I'm not despairing. I just think that, if anything, if we can get more people understanding what's going on and being more informed about it, then there'll be less likely to be rash decisions made by management agencies. It is going to require significant investments from communities and government agencies to manage the coastal zone around the bay, to maintain its biodiversity as well as the recreational amenity of beach goers. So there's going to need to be very well informed decisions made as to where the best investment should be. It will be very challenging, there's no doubt about that.
Neil explains there are already significant issues we have to deal with. We need to face challenges now.
So it's been accepted now that state government has taken a conservative view that we're looking at 800 millimetres of sea level rise by 2100. That's the case, then that's going to have significant implications for our coast, and particularly the habitats along the coast, because any changes in sea level rise will alter the sediments, etc., significantly. As well as the infrastructure that's going to be pushing up again.
A baykeeper's role is to educate and encourage community advocates. Neil hopes the community will get behind him and support his project. If you want to be involved in this community challenge, head down to the Macrae car park near the end of Coburn Avenue on Point Nepean Road at 1:30 p.m. this Thursday, the 14th of July. Look for a man with a long white beard. Thanks to Brendan Telfer and the Breakfast Boys for that report. Next, we ask Minister for the Environment, Greg Hunt, for his views on the Victorian Government Bay Report. And coming up, details about a candlelight vigil for murdered Dermot O'Toole. Does Mr. Hunt believe changes in the bay and the shoreline are cyclical and natural, or is climate change and dredging playing a part?
I think the main thing in terms of climate change and what we've seen around the world, including Australia, is about a 20-centimetre rise over the last 130-odd years.
Is that to be concerned about? That sounds
and,
to be
well, that is what has happened, and so the broader climate change issue is very, very important. What I'm not sure about, because I haven't seen this particular report to which you're referring, is whether or not Neil is referencing the dredging that they did, and in particular the increased flow through the heads. There has been a report that I know that the Port of Melbourne issued, I think against their will, which showed that the dredging and blasting at the heads had led to the damage at Portsea Beach, and I think that that's just common sense, that faster flow of water in the near the heads at the southern end of the peninsula has had an impact. I think it's just overwhelmingly common sense and backed up by the real-world lived experience. One of the things that I fought against is this idea of a Bay West project, which would involve 110 million tonnes of dredging. So I think the state should be rethinking that proposal.
$2 million spend for the Marine Research Station at Point Nepean. That's going to go ahead now. That would be really useful to watch water levels in the Port Phillip Bay our marine life.
Actually, that's one of the things that I envisage and imagine that they will do. And, you know, it's Melbourne University, and they'll head up a National Centre for Coast and Climate. That commitment is locked in, and it's something I'm really excited about.
Eye on the Peninsula will keep you updated with reports and progress made in the Bay with rising water levels and shoreline changes. Stay with us, because coming up is the Bandicoot's latest on councillors overspending. And ahead, we hear about a local archer's dream to win gold in the 2016 Olympics. The Bandicoot is back. Yes, David Harrison has returned from a break and joins Brendan Telfer briefly for a quick update on Councillor Antonella Celli's overspending controversy.
The overspend by Councillor Antonella Celli was still causing a few ripples. I got a copy of the legal advice that the Shire got to justify allowing Councillor Celli to retain the $9,000 that she had overspent, but her fellow councillors resolved she had not overspent. The legal advice is very interesting, actually, in what it says and what it doesn't say, in what it seems the council didn't tell the lawyers in their instructions, which seems to have perhaps impaired the law firm's ability to come to a full piece of advice.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, because there are some members of the council who I think do have a different view about all this. Does that give them some sort of right of appeal? Will they pursue this, do you think?
It's hard to know, but I get the feeling that the matter's not over yet, although it's been resolved by the councillors. As Councillor Tim Wood said at a meeting, he said there's nothing to stop the councillor from voluntarily repaying the amount that's overspent, and that seems to me to be a fairly reasonable view. The Shire is dealing in ratepayers' money, basically, and with some government grants, but basically it's ratepayers' money. Probably quite a lot of ratepayers who could probably find ways to spend that $9,000 that Councillor Celli was overpaid, many of them possibly in her own Sea Winds ward.
Last night, David attended a council meeting, and details will be brought to you next week. But he had this to say.
Paris conference that caused all the ruckus in the first place is going to be settled, and the figures are that neither Councillor Pittick nor Councillor Fraser, who went to that conference, overspent their $16,000 limit. That $16,000 limit has been very closely looked at, and I remembered a meeting in November. Those allowances were first approved after some vigorous debate.
Google the Mornington Peninsula Bandicoot Facebook page for more epic stories and watch out for the launch of his website. It's happened. City Life and Frankston Church's Breakfast Club in Frankston closed their doors last week after patrons, supporters and volunteers served the final meal to the most vulnerable people in our community. Pastor Mark Whitby, who runs City Life, spoke about the disappointing loss of the charities after negotiations broke down with government bureaucrats and Frankston State Labor MP Paul Edbrook over a new base. RPPFM presenters of Breakfast Radio, Brendan and Brody, take up the story.
Yes, it's rather disappointing, I guess, that we found ourselves without a home ourselves.
It's an extraordinary situation because it's not as if the Shire, nor indeed local members of Parliament, didn't appear to be getting themselves involved, but what happened?
I think in hindsight, I was probably a little naive. I think I trusted them a little implicitly without getting engaged myself.
Now I'm wondering about the poor people of Frankston. I mean, you've been basically feeding them. You've been giving them wonderful breakfasts. You've been caring for them, giving them a place. You're gone. I mean, what happens?
Yeah, well, what's happened since our service finished last week, the Frankston Local Council have cobbled together some meals from different places. There is an intention for the state government to, at the end of August, to start their own service, take over the things we've been doing.
Could you tell us how many breakfasts you were doing?
Well, the breakfasts are run by the Breakfast Club. It's a little complex, but the Breakfast Club are a different organisation to us. They
right.
work with us. They have about 100 volunteers. They've been doing around about 65 breakfasts a day.
Right.
They've been running for 20 years in Frankston, and they've also ceased as of last Thursday. City Life is doing around about 16,000 meals a year, so we were feeding around about 100 people a day.
So what is the issue here then, Mark? Is it the fact that you haven't got an industrial kitchen
area in order to prepare the food, or you haven't got a place to serve it?
Well, we don't now, of course, but we have had an industrial kitchen out. One of the problems with us has been the amount of clients we gather. We're the largest cohort of disadvantage in Frankston, and we gather a lot of people. And so any site to replace us would have had the ability to gather those people in a way that doesn't create a public issue.
But, Mike, I can't believe that the government's, you know, getting involved in this and they don't have a solution until August. Yeah. I mean, it's been going on for months. Why isn't it solved now?
It's very complex, to be honest. They approached me around about 18 months ago when they heard that we needed to re-site, looked at our service and said, this is so important, we need to help you going forward. Spent quite a bit of energy and money developing a plan for us, which we, as a board, felt, hey, this is great, you know, we have a plan, and I've never worked with the government previously, so I sort of took them at face value, believing that they would help us. And after many months, they finally approached us at the board, thinking, and we thought they were going to give us a solution. We had some things on the table that they talked to us about, and they approached us and said, this is the solution, and if you don't take it, we're going to bring in another service to replace you, which we thought was a bit outrageous, frankly. But
what was the solution?
Well, the solution was they offered us an old dentist surgery in Beach Street, which we thought was pretty inadequate, so we told them so. But after the meeting, we went down to the dentist surgery, and it's got a tenant in it. And we approached them, and we said, listen, the government's offered us this building, and they were pretty upset with us. What do you mean? They said, our building, we rent it. And so we went back, and they also offered us next door to that is the CWA hall. We also spoke to them and said, listen, the government has said that we can use your... And they said, we don't know anything about this.
If it's a real estate issue, is there not an opportunity, for example, an opportunity where there could be a delivery mechanism, say, food supply caravans that go to parks and areas, but the food is produced in an industrial kitchen and then siphoned out from there?
I think that's quite possible. In fact, I think that's what the government are kind of going to do. They've actually got a service that's come into Frankston, Winteringham, and they've actually bought a property in Frankston, and they're going to be using their kitchens to produce meals, and I suspect they'll be serving them out of somewhere else.
Is this going to cost us, however, Mark?
The government's already put, I think, $400,000 up to pay for...
But this was cost neutral while you were running it.
Well, it was cost neutral. Well, you know, city life, we've never taken government money. We've been running a long time, since 1988, and I started City Life, and we've never, ever had government funding, either state nor federal. We've taken a little bit of council money, not very much, but we've raised all our own support. Just to put it in the picture, it was costing us approximately $31,000 a month to look after the disadvantaged. Over the last 11 years, we've spent just over $4 million on the disadvantaged of Frankston. And that's out of our pockets. You know, we have been happy to do that. We've never asked for government support. We have philanthropic people, and we have a lot of companies that give us support. And we've run a really large op shop on our site, so we deal a lot with Frankston community. One of the things about us, and I think it's important to say this, is we're not just about the service delivery, but it's about the people that work with us. So we provide a mechanism whereby people can come and support people, and it's holistic in that sense, and it gives people the opportunity to serve other people. And we have a lot of volunteers.
That's going to be the other great loss as well. I mean, this investment in people and humanity in Frankston, and suddenly to have it ripped out and some sort of government agency come in at a cost to us as taxpayers, when you have done this.
The government will give you a different read on this. I'll say that they offered us these things, and they've publicly said we were offered $400,000, which is completely untrue, by the way. We were never offered any money at all, and told this story, and I've corrected it with a public press release. I've been forced to defend ourselves against this, which has been pretty sad. To be frank, the Frankston Breakfast have been very, very wounded through this. They're mostly a group of elderly people, and I think they have probably suffered more than we have, because we have other strings to our bow. They do one thing, they cook a breakfast every morning, and that's now sleep.
Mark and his team will rise against all odds to provide the most basic human rights to our vulnerable people on the streets, food and comfort. I on the Peninsula will update you on the next stage of Mark's fight. But coming up now, David Gill and Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock comment on the Summers concrete footpath situation, which is in disarray. And stay with us for details on the fate of the submarine Otama. Last week, Eye on the Peninsula aired part one of the complex issue with the Summers Special Footpath Scheme and Summers Community Group that is dividing the small coastal township. With the case going before VCAT in October this year, there have been allegations made by people in Summers that the Mornington Peninsula Shire has been keeping information from certain community groups that is raising many questions. Deborah continues the report with David Gill, a former Mornington Peninsula councillor, about how will the councillor's voting system change the direction of the special footpath scheme.
Every single person with a postcode in Summers was being charged, even if they lived 2 kilometres away. That just shows you how crazy the system is. And that is an aspect that's never happened before, and it should be challenged. The council and the old group in Summers got it passed at council. The council wanted it because it's a glorious way of getting people to pay for their own infrastructure rather than coming out of our rates. When this matter went to the council for a vote, the mayor and one other councillor voted in favour of the residents of Summers, and the other 9 voted for the scheme. One's retired, there's now 10. There's 2 votes against the scheme. It needs a change of 3 councillor votes. So once you get to 5, the mayor is one of those people, so there's a possibility of it being put away where it deserves to be.
So he has to choose.
The mayor would have a casting vote. So it's in a difficult situation in terms of the officers and the councillors. They've not wanted to know the real information. They've made it very difficult for people to change their minds. But now we have a new piece of evidence that's happening. The council at the last meeting on Tuesday the 14th of June decided to get rid of a number of the schemes of this sort, user pays, special charge schemes, because they've realised that people in those areas didn't want them. The mistake they made was they had a local group do all the work for them, do the surveys, give them the information, and the information was wrong. But they accepted that information as true and went ahead with a scheme that should never have got off the ground. Now they're finding with these other schemes that they are not supported by local people and they won't get off the ground. We just want the same thing to happen for Summers.
Can't the groups come together and capitulate on a solution that works for everyone?
In a sense it has, but one group has gotten very little support.
Which one's that one?
The Summers Residents Association. People joined that group because it was the only group, and people in Summers very community-minded. But now there's another group with instantly 500 members, and that's roughly the sort of membership the old group had over many years. So it's now become a select few people who have lost support from the people that should be supporting them as their local representatives in their township. Remember, this is a small coastal village that doesn't want a great deal of change. It doesn't want the big things to happen suddenly.
Can't you two just come together and capitulate on something that's going to work for everybody, or is it just concrete paths or no concrete paths?
No, I think the new group, the Summers Village Community Association, said from the beginning that they would compromise, that they would mediate, which they're doing at VCAT. And their idea was where there is a problem, we need to solve it. There wasn't a problem with the paths that exist, which are gravel. What they wanted was more of the gravel paths where they're necessary, but also to look at the curb areas where sometimes there'll be need for some infrastructure because it's more difficult to get down onto the road from the old paths or from what is this lawn or grass in some areas. And they were very willing to look at those issues, but the council wasn't. The council wanted 2 metre wide for half of the village and then 1.5 metre for the rest, concrete paths with no compromise, with no real idea of what people wanted except for surveys run by people who were proponents of the scheme.
Can't you just look at the main road where the school is?
That's where the compromise would come.
And this from David to sum up the matter.
The zonings on the other side of the peninsula are different. They are for coastal villages. They have green wedges. They have protection from overdevelopment. But they haven't got protection from poor council decision-making when it comes to the look of an area go and have a drive around and just enjoy Somers and see what we mean about keeping a coastal village character. The council's in big trouble. They've been caught out. They've been caught out misleading people. We've got the evidence. We're pursuing it with the Ombudsman, who I believe visited Somers on this issue yesterday. And also we're pursuing it with the local government department. We don't like being misled, and we believe that's what the council has done to the people of Somers.
Hope you can all foot the bill.
Thanks very much. That might be the hard part.
And lastly, Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock has been caught up in the debate and starts by saying...
tends to have polarised members of that community, which is a really sad thing when really the purpose was always, if anything, to strengthen that community.
Well, I understand that it needs three councillors to agree to no footpaths to go ahead. There's two that have come forward. Will you come forward to be the third one?
No, I won't. No, I personally think that the footpath, as designed by the Shire, is an excellent thing for the township of Somers. Let's face it, it rings the township. It doesn't crisscross it or anything like that. It basically connects a whole bunch of existing paths already, and it will... not be an eyesore. It will be really good for people, particularly people who are more elderly, people who are required to use walkers and mobility scooters, or children. I think it will be a wonderful thing for the town, and I'm actually very supportive of it. I do believe that there are a number of people who have very, very strong views against it, and I understand that some of their fears.
So what fears do the Somers community have who oppose the concrete exposed aggregate footpaths? Councillor Garnock confirms.
They're claiming that it'll be having a cement footpath, or exposed aggregate is the correct term, will destroy the coastal village look and feel of the town. And I don't think it will. We're connecting a whole bunch of existing footpaths, and it's a ring around the urban part of town. It'll make access easier for everybody around the town that want to go jogging or walking. I just can't see that it's going to be as disastrous for the look and feel of the town as some people are saying.
The case goes before VCAT on the 24th of October with a number of community meetings scheduled in the lead-up. We'll bring you up to date with the Somers debate as details come to hand before and after the VCAT hearing. Ahead, Alec Potts is on a mission to win gold in the upcoming Olympics. But now, today marks the senseless attack and killing of Hastings jeweller Dermot O'Toole. This evening at 5 p.m, the small community at Hastings will hold a candlelight vigil to remember and honour the man who was stabbed to death with a carving knife and died in the arms of his wife. Deborah Maher spoke to Angie Baker from Marketing and Promotions at Western Port Chamber of Commerce about the Go Green for Dermot tribute to a man who loved his community.
In regards to the Western Port Chamber of Commerce, we are pulling together the community and the businesses, especially the traders, and asking them to decorate their shop fronts in green in memory of Dermot O'Toole. And the Mornington Peninsula Shire have been fantastic supporters in helping us promote the event and support the family. At 5 o'clock on Tuesday the 12th of July, we're having a candlelit vigil in the O'Toole Walk with family and friends and all the community.
What's the mood been like at past candlelight vigils, and will this one be any different?
The past 2 years we've had a ceremony and a release of balloons with the community, and this year we changed it to the candlelit vigil at 5 o'clock purely because there's some new lighting that's been put into the laneway, and also to just to change the theme. In the past, it's been quite a very quiet moment, but it's also too been a great reflection and time for the family to get together with the people that they've been in the community with for the last 40 years. So it's been yet sad. It's been a great community draw card to bring everyone together.
And there's the O'Toole Walk is where it will be held at 5 o'clock at 52 High Street in Hastings. Has the township gotten over the terrible tragedy what happened on this day 3 years ago?
Personally, I believe it's not something that people get over. It's something that is always going to be there, but it's something that can pull people together and
Definitely, Bridget, and speaking with the family, they love the fact that community have come together and put together the walk and decorated the laneway in memory of Dermot. And it's something that their family and the grandchildren like to come down and visit, and it's a happy place for them. So really, it's not something that can be forgotten, but it's something that can bring people together.
How are the family feeling about it? How are they dealing with the situation that did happen 3 years ago?
That's something you probably need to ask the family, but I think that it's really changed their world and nothing will be the same. And I don't think it's something that they deal very well with, but they just get on with what they can, I guess.
All right, so that's the candlelight vigil. Just go through those details again, if you wouldn't mind.
So Tuesday, 5 p.m. at O'Toole Walk, just off High Street, Hastings, and that's next to Things Dry Cleaners and also to the National Australian Bank in the laneway. At 5 o'clock.
And everybody is encouraged to wear something green.
That would be great.
Deborah will attend the candlelight vigil this evening and bring you coverage on Eye on the Peninsula next week when she speaks to a family member of the late Mr. O'Toole. Come along and support the people of Hastings and the O'Toole family at the O'Toole Walk in High Street, Hastings, starting today at 5 p.m. Now, the submarine that wants to be on land for all to see. The fate of the submarine Otama is still unknown, as part of our maritime history is half submerged off the shores of Hastings. President of the Western Port Oberon Association, Max Bryant, advised it will cost $15 million to raise Otama on land and feature it as a tourist attraction. Cerberus Ward, Councillor David Garnock, comments on the fate of Otama, starting with, "Is there some truth she will be scrapped as reported in the local newspaper recently?"
Oh, look, I think that would be the most horrible final outcome and the one we must avoid at all costs. You know, there's been a team of people who have been working on this project for 14 years now. There's been a lot of money spent on it, not only by the federal government initially to get the submarine around here, but also by the members and other contributors, you know, philanthropic contributors over the years. And the last thing we want to do is scrap it. I'm still pushing along with many others, and at three levels of government, I might add, to do what we can to help get that submarine ashore in Hastings, where it will be a terrific tourist attraction for the region and certainly boost businesses in Hastings.
Costings for the project are very grey. Councillor Garnock explains.
My concern has been that really up until the last couple of months, no one's been able to tell us exactly how much the project would cost. I recall initially when I first became a councillor being told it would be about $1 million to get it high and dry. Then it was two, then three, then five, now $7 million just to get it high and dry, and then another $7 or $8 million to build the interpretive centre and all that sort of stuff. So a total of $15 million there. Now that we've got a tighter rein in on the figures, I think the project team will be in a better position to write up a strong case. They've already got the justification, and we all agree that it would be a great boon to tourism in the region. But it's more now, how does it happen? How do you actually do that? So, for instance, bringing the submarine into Hastings alone, down the channel, it's a fairly narrow, winding channel. It would be the largest vessel that has ever entered Hastings. So we need to confirm that the channel into Hastings is dredged deep enough to be able to take the submarine, you know, allowed to even get into Hastings.
And, of course, that takes more money too.
That's right. It's just difficult to confirm whether or not that sort of dredging or the potential for need for dredging in the Hastings channel is actually factored into that $7 million. I still haven't seen a detailed costing of the bid.
So who is working on the costings?
I know Max and his team are working on that. The best chance they've got, of course, is to seek funding from numerous sources. I know that there were plans about a year ago to submit a bid to the Stronger Regions Fund, a federal fund through Greg Hunt's office. For some reason, it didn't happen. They didn't submit the application, and now, of course, we're in caretaker mode, so no prospect there. But after the elections, hopefully, irrespective of which government gets in, hopefully something like a Stronger Regions Fund will be reinitiated and the project team can bid for some funding there. Max is working
closely with the tourism minister in Victorian state government and ports minister. Hopefully the state government will cough up some funding too. Then, of course, you must have philanthropic funding. And I think when businesses see that this submarine is definitely going to come ashore in Hastings, they will be climbing over each other to throw money towards it because they will know that it's going to be a winner from a business perspective.
And employment and also drawing people to that area. And it's just fitting. It has to happen. We just have to get her out of the water so that she's not going to erode any further and then you can take it from there. I think that's the first thing to do.
Yeah.
So it's not just simply lifting Otama out of the water to land. There are so many variables and considerations before the project gets off the ground. It's all to do with cost. Thank you to Deborah Maher and Councillor Garnock for that report. Lastly, Sam Mills speaks to an archer with gold in his sights. Stay tuned. Hopefully we'll be hearing our national anthem often as our chosen athletes push up the Australian medal tally in the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. But we know every 4 years the best athletes from around the globe converge in one place to showcase their talents and strive for that ever-elusive gold medal. The Olympics are just around the corner, and in 2016 they'll be held in Brazil's second most populous city, Rio de Janeiro. While there's been much debate about the Games taking place amid concerns of the Zika virus, some athletes, like Madalisa's archer superstar Alec Potts, just can't wait to get over there. Sam Mills sat down with Alec ahead of his trip and opens with the Zika virus threat.
I think it'd be silly to say it's not a concern of mine, but I mean, the AOC and the organising committee of the Olympics has taken every precaution they can. And I mean, we're taking over half a shipping container full of mosquito nets and bug spray and repellents. And Rio itself, being on the coast, is going to be less prone to having those kind of outbreaks than further into Brazil and the rainforests. Everything seems to be running really smoothly. I mean, the village looks great. We've got a nice Australian high-rise to ourselves, and we're going to have performance people in the village. Like, we'll have physios and psychs and stuff to help us out. We're actually really lucky to be training off-site, so it's only about 10 minutes or so from the actual village, which will save us driving the hour into the venue each day when we want to train. So it's looking, especially from an Australian team perspective, it's looking really good.
Sam asks where Alex spent his childhood and what attracted him to archery.
Well, I was born in Clayton, then moved to the UK when I was 2.5, so I was over there for about 10 years or so. And then coming back here when I was 12, I've probably been on a peninsula for the last 7 or 8 years or so, kind of mentalised Frankston Southway. I suppose growing up in the UK played a big role in that just because the curriculum over there was so dense with medieval history. And I really liked fencing, tried that and was terrible, so threw that out the window straight away. Came back to Australia and got into archery.
There is more to archery than meets the eye. What are Alex's expectations competing in the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio?
What was the qualifying process for the Games and what are your expectations for the month ahead?
It was really long. We started last year to get a minimum qualifying score, and four of us made that final cut. We then went through to the first World Cup of this year in Shanghai, which is worth 40%. Then following that, we had a camp in Brisbane, which is worth the remaining 60%. And I was lucky enough to perform really well in China, which kind of carried me through the rest of the process. I don't want to sit here and say I'm going to go over there and win gold. I mean, I don't think that's a good perspective to be going into it with. But I think realistically, especially from a team perspective, I mean, Ryan's a world champion, Taylor's an Olympian. I have my good days now and then. And if we all get together on the one day and everything just works, I mean, I've seen what we're capable of in practice. And if we can lay that out on the field, we'll be very competitive.
Who are your inspirations, both generally and sporting-wise? And do you see archery as a long or short-term proposition?
Sporting-wise, I'd have to say the likes of Simon Fairweather and David Barnes. Simon, multiple-time Olympian, world champion. David Barnes was hugely successful as a junior. And growing up through the Australian archery junior system, there's so many of his records that he holds that have been a real goal of mine through all of my junior career in the sport. And generally would probably have to be my dad, just purely because of the discipline that he's shown me. So it helps me to kind of stay disciplined in my training routines and getting out of bed in the morning to go off and shoot in the cold and the rain. It can definitely be long-term. I mean, we've got people in the sport that are the 5-time, 6-time Olympians. I mean, Matty, who was our reserve for the Games, he was 42 or 43 for this trials, and he was still, you know, he was very much in the running for it. So I think looking at him really shows me that you can stay at a really high level in the sport for a long time. So I'll get through this cycle first and then see if I want to continue. But I think you can definitely be in the sport for a long term, especially at Olympic elite level.
Sports like archery receive a boost every 4 years thanks to the increased coverage. Can you see archery becoming more popular, particularly on the peninsula?
It'd be fantastic if it did. We've had a lot of movies in the last 4 or 5 years with archery in it. It's really grown the participation rates in sport. It's just so accessible for kids of any age, for older people, people with disabilities. It would be really nice to have it further out in the spotlight. There's a game I play when I go up to Brisbane, so I get a lot of taxis from the airport to our training venue, and every time you mention archery and you talk about the Olympics, they always go, oh, Simon Fairweather. And I mean, here we are 16 years later and he's still remembered. I mean, to even be able to scratch the surface of a legacy like that would just be incredible.
Best of luck to Alec and the Australian Olympic team. Hopefully the medal tally is more flattering this time round than in 2012. Thanks to Sam Mills for compiling that report. That concludes our program for the week. If you have any news from the street you want to share with our team, please contact RPPFM on 5975 1234. Next week, Eye on the Peninsula will again bring you up to date with issues that matter. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 or 98.3 FM. You can live stream from our website, rpfm.com.au, and download the RPPFM app. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website, and check out the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. Don't forget the Briars Ward Community Meeting coming up on Thursday the 21st of July at the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council Chambers, starting at 6 p.m. Go to the Mourn Pen website for details. Thanks to Deborah Maher, Executive Producer of Eye on the Peninsula, reporter Sam Mills, Brendan Telfer, Brody Gouzet, and Kevin Wilcox, our news researcher. And if you're interested in presenting your own radio program on RPPFM or reporting for Eye on the Peninsula, contact our station manager, Brendan Telfer, on 5975 1234. I'm Piers Cunningham. Thanks for your company.